Over decades, Warhammer 40,000 has become a galaxy-spanning narrative, filled with ancient horrors, unstoppable armies, and mysteries all but lost to time. Yet some of the major lore elements have been left hanging for so long that it's fair to now ask the question, can they ever be resolved? And without breaking the entire verse. From alien horrors that should have by now easily conquered a large part of the galaxy, to key characters written into a corner with seemingly no way forward. Today we're diving into the five biggest problems in 40k lore the Games Workshop either can't fix or is extremely reluctant to move forward with. So before I move on to another narrative video, I wanted to do this one that's been in my head for quite a while, because I think it's something we all have considered from time to time. And so for me, the absolutely crazy, glaring issues are as much fun for me to discuss and consider as is the overall narrative itself, and inevitably, the oddities of the lore will be something we all question from time to time. On the other hand, this is actually a serious issue. Because I honestly think that what we will discuss today could be problematic in the long term for 40k. It's an issue we see in other major verse narratives, that of writing yourself into a corner. We've well seen how other IPs can be reduced to basically a grey sludge that nobody cares about, or by just introducing things which make absolutely no sense or break entirely any sense of immersion. And unlike my other video recently, today you're going to get a full intro, because context. But just before that, if you like this video today, please do hit that like, maybe even consider subscribing to the channel if you aren't already, and also tell me your thoughts about today's topic of problematic lore dead ends. Are there any other lore problems which keep you awake at night due to them being seemingly unresolvable? Or maybe some ticking time bomb that nobody mentions but is there just waiting to go off? Tell me in the comments below. Now, I've said recently that due to its nature and the fact that at this point Warhammer 40,000's lore is absolutely massive, the galaxy of M41 exists as more of a platform by which to tell stories rather than an overarching narrative itself. Which is both true and by design. Yet at the same time, it feels ever more the case that Games Workshop may be slowly writing themselves into a corner. But it's certainly not about the writing quality. In fact, some of the recent novels have been the best we've ever seen. The End and the Death books by Dan Abnett were just, quite honestly, some of the best fiction I've ever read in my life, and a lot of the new material expanding the story of the Imperium has been both gripping and inspiring. But over the years, it's remained very clear that in terms of the lore moving forward, this is something that is not completely ignored, but certainly resisted. It's already problematic that there are within the lore many contradictions, power scaling issues, or other outright unsolvable problems, all of which contribute to the issue of the glacial movement of the overarching narrative. As I've said ever more regularly, I think it's genuinely possible I may never live to see what happens with the Emperor, and whilst originally that was a joke, I came to realise that it may not be, because in the past 8 years for the lore of 40k, all that's really happened is Gilliman returned, the Great Rift, and that's about it. In 8 years, yeah, the Indomitus Crusade, Tyranids, but it's been 2 years already since the Lion returned, and he still hasn't met up with Gilliman to discuss the dire state of things. But returning to that glacial pace of 40k, at this point it is certainly not any kind of mistake. It is clearly deliberate, and I think the simple reason continues to be that 40k being slow-walked, even now, is due to the fact that it serves mainly as the backdrop for the tabletop game. Which for me is obviously distressing, but it's something we are always well aware of. Because despite the lore side of things becoming ever more prominent, 40k exists in this very strange state, where, unlike most fictional worlds, it lives at the behest of the tabletop, and not the other way around. Because I would say it's generally more common to see a narrative world start as a script or novel, and then it's developed into a media series, a film. Eventually, you might get some kind of video or physical game out of it. But the story and the IP is generally what is at the core of its value. In 40K, the relationship between all these things is really unusual, because the story was developed not in isolation or as a pure narrative, but to support the tabletop game. Originally, when 40K Rogue Trader and even the fabled second edition of 40K came into being in the 80s and early 90s, the lore was pretty set, because it had no need to really develop any further. That was until the arrival of the 8th edition. This was when things really got a heavy shake-up with the Gathering Storm. It was the point at which we began to feel the lore of the contemporary period in M41 move forward in a genuinely meaningful way, and I'm pretty sure on one of my early videos when I started to get back into talking about 40K, I made the comment of, I really hope this is where things are going, that we start getting a forward-moving lore, which is exactly what has happened. Now, with all that said, I'm no proponent of just rushing things forward with crazy abandon, not worrying about the potential damage which this could cause. That is also potentially very problematic. The point is, they started moving forward with things, and that is good, and I like it, and ultimately it's necessary, because it brought many people back to paying full attention to 40K, new people into the space. This all ensured the survival of Warhammer 40,000. But there remained, however, one small problem. The tabletop lore mentality. Ultimately, what I mean by this is that when the 8th edition came along, they should have separated the lore in terms of its ongoing development from the tabletop. This way, it could have moved forward faster with major narrative changes whilst still supporting the tabletop. The tabletop doesn't really need the big details. They can just have interesting campaigns like Charadon and Octarius, because they just want to do fighting and battles. That is all they need. Instead, they of course decided to keep the two things locked together, as had always been the case. Which means no matter how much we want to see things move forward, perhaps dramatically, it cannot, because it has to remain tethered to the tabletop. It has to be locked into the cycle of yearly tabletop supporting releases. There is always this kind of sense with people that the lore dictates what units can be used on the tabletop, hence Commissar Yarrick disappearing, killed off screen, and being removed then as a playable unit from the Imperial Guard. Now, of course, we know Yarrick, he may not be dead, but nonetheless, it shows how those two things are inextricably linked. So it is this issue which contributes to the glacial pace of the major lore developments in 40K, because the tabletop is pinning it down, anchoring it from moving forward, or it may dictate them. And in the period we may consider as being the foundational lore of 40K, we're talking the first, second, and third edition, with the caveat of the major Necron rewrite later in fifth, there was no particular intention that I can see for the lore to ever begin expanding in the manner we see now. It was a stationary backdrop for the game, it was never needed to move forward, it was a galaxy of unending war, constant, permanent, that's what it was. Now things have changed completely. 40K now seems to be progressing in something approaching a linear, almost real-time fashion, where we're following characters like Gilliman, Abaddon, Kaul, the Necrons collectively. Their stories are interwoven and contribute to developments dramatically. New material, new novels come out almost every week, and there are multiple lore drops pending, all which have big implications, which traditionally for 40K was not the case. Now you might be asking yourself, why is any of that a problem? Well, today we're talking about lore problems with no straightforward solution, from the scale of the Tyranids to the power of the Necron and of course the Emperor. All have huge stakes attached to them, but not because it fits the current developments. It's due to the fact that in the old way of doing 40K lore, these were designed to be a hanging narrative sword. They existed to create the grim, dark sense that at any moment the end would come. We just didn't know which end it would be. Would the Imperium destroy all? Could chaos emerge and wreak horror on the galaxy? Would the Tyranids sweep in with the bulk of their force and scour everything? or when the Necron finally emerged, would they just exterminate everything? Which is fine, so long as you never actually reach a point at which you have to then address that insanely overpowered threat in a real sense. But now, as the lore begins to move forward properly, finally, all of these elements are actually becoming problematic. So let us begin with what I view as the most problematic of them all, because whichever way you cut it, it's been built up so much that it's hard to find a solution which is not now anticlimactic. It's the dragons are coming of 40k, the Tyranids. So among the many threats which loom over the galaxy, the Tyranids stand out as one of the most terrifying and insurmountable. They're a relentless, all-consuming horror who have entered the galaxy from its fringe, driven by an insatiable hunger. They threaten to devour all life, scouring worlds as they do. Now, I've always thought you could have just left it at that. You didn't really need to add anything to make it even more scary or workable in the 40k verse. But of course, because everything in 40k has to be turned up to 11, Games Workshop decided one of the additional foundational lore concepts that would be repeatedly implied in their lore and that now cannot be separated from the Tyranids is the fact that every Tyranid High Fleet encountered so far is just a scout force. Which very obviously is a major, major problem. It creates this inescapable situation that a vastly greater Tyranid force is waiting beyond the galaxy, and thus the entire setting is then hopelessly doomed. At the same time, because it's been so relentlessly restated, if they were to now just start downplaying this aspect of the Tyranids and saying, oh, you know what, actually, there wasn't as many as we thought, that's going to undermine their established lore and make them seem just less terrifying, almost potentially a non-issue. But that in itself isn't the only problem with the Tyranids. It's been illustrated elsewhere in the existing lore, such as the Ultramarines defeating High Fleet Behemoth. It was one of the most legendary examples of Tyranids versus the Imperium. It saw the Ultramarines' homeworld almost overrun and some of their most veteran Astartes exterminated. How did the Imperium ultimately solve the problem? They just took a ship, made its reactors critical, and then destroyed the Hive ships. So by that logic, can't we just do that now, immediately, as soon as they see Hive ships appear? It's basically the end of Independence Day, but in 40k. Because from the very beginning, the Tyranids are framed as this apocalyptic threat, and that they are truly terrifying, because unlike the Imperium with its internal strife and inefficiencies, the Tyranids don't have any division, they don't have diplomacy, they don't have alternative goals beyond consumption. They're an alien force in the truest possible sense. Their methods of warfare are aggressive, rapid evolution, overwhelming numbers, and nightmarish bioweapons. Yet, it is this continual assertion that no matter how many victories the Imperium or other factions achieve, it's all futile. If every war against the Tyranids is inherently meaningless because the real threat is yet to arrive, then there's no tension or triumph or sense of hope of accomplishment in these conflicts. It reduces the stakes of any Tyranid campaign to just some temporary extension of survival rather than a genuine blow of achievement being dealt. So for me, the Tyranids are actually a major narrative problem. Games Workshop has written itself into this no-win situation with the Tyranids because they can't change it without completely undermining the threat of the Tyranid. But it's impossible for them to follow through on the main narrative story behind them because then there's no reasonable scenario in which the Imperium or indeed anybody can resist them. A full-scale Tyranid invasion of the galaxy would just render all other storylines meaningless and dead, and in such a scenario, the setting of 40k would either have to end in this catastrophic Tyranid victory, or be somehow artificially sustained through contrived mechanisms, thereby prolonging the narrative, and I think the latter is exactly how it's going to go. But this problem is only exacerbated by the sense of having to maintain balance within the setting. Warhammer 40,000 thrives on the idea that no single faction can just dominate, which keeps the universe in this perpetual state of conflict. But if the Tyranids are as powerful as the lore suggests, then they should just logically win. However, for narrative and game design reasons, they very obviously cannot do so. So it's this contradiction that makes them one of the most difficult factions in terms of storytelling. Nonetheless, I decided to throw out a few possible ideas here. Now, as we know, the Tyranids consume biomass to sustain their growth. So introducing some kind of hard limit on how much they can realistically use to sustain themselves would help to balance their threat. This could be done by introducing perhaps some kind of engineered virus during a major Imperium campaign, perhaps with some kind of ancient viral technology from the Dark Age of technology, something which could inhibit their ability to efficiently absorb biomass, or which restricts the types of life form they're able to consume so as to continually evolve effectively. Basically, whatever means you wish to imagine, something which makes them less efficiently able to consume and thereby give them a sense of diminishing return for their consumption. This could leave the Tyranids still enough of a threat as to be terrifying and problematic, but more manageable. Next, we consider their dependence on psychic energy. Now, I've talked about this before when we looked at the recent Necron developments. The Tyranid hive mind relies heavily on psychic communication. This overuse of psychic energy can be, though, a double-edged sword for them, because whilst powerful, it also risks their entire state of being if disrupted. And so the Necron, for example, have null field technology. It could be that the Imperium could develop or use something similar to disrupt the cohesion of or entirely block the Tyranids from advancing and progressing in their relentless advance, thereby making them far easier to deal with. So while the Tyranids are often depicted as a unified force under the hive mind, in truth, we don't really know anything about them. There have been psychers who have looked into the hive mind, it's true, but again, what they see doesn't really answer much for us. And it does open this realm of speculation. It's always been presumed that Tyranid fleets are operating as part of a singular mind, but what if they were not? What if some sort of psychic schism occurred, which introduced split factions or mutations that began to resist central control? Maybe a particularly brutal war in a region of the galaxy forces the Tyranids to push their advanced evolution to the extreme, and in so doing, they also then begin to create major errors in their biology. It spreads and becomes so serious that the mutations begin fighting for their own survival, and a schism in their psychic control occurs. Thus, in a firestorm of biomass consumption, the Tyranids split into two groups, each committed to destroying the other. I feel like this would be particularly interesting because it would still leave them as an extreme threat, but in now having to fight against themselves as well as everybody else, it would make them seem far less invincible in the long term. Then lastly, the age-old enemy of my enemy. The Necron dynasties have all manner of goals. Some of their number seek subjugation or experimentation upon the mortal beings of the galaxy, others want to just destroy and exterminate everything. But it is one of the goals of the Silent King to find living vessels and reverse the process of biotransference, and allow the Necron to exist as a living civilization once again. Now, while not all the Necron nobility would agree, it's conceivable that a good number of Necron will object to alien horrors arbitrarily exterminating all life from the galaxy. In the past, the Necron lore would have been 100% okay with this, but now not so much. So it is possible that some awakened dynasties could truly begin throwing major power in the direction of the Tyranids, and with little if any biomass to recover from the Necrons, the losses for Tyranids could be immense. Now there is one drawback though. Necrons really do not like psychic power. It is very much their kryptonite, and the Tyranids have psychic power which is off the scale. However, Necrons have their pariah nexus as well. So in the end, does it all balance out? Now these are all just ideas off the top of my head, and as always, we could undoubtedly imagine many, many more. But the goal here is really to just try and suggest some solutions to these problems, to maintain the Tyranids as a terrifying ever-present threat, whilst also avoiding the narrative dead end that their current depiction appears to create. For me, it renders all other victories quite hollow, but I don't think anybody wants to see the Tyranids disappear, nor be any less of a threat at the same time. They're a fascinating faction, they're horrifying, they're perfectly suited to the grimdark horror of M41, but I think surely it's time to find a good balance between their threat and remaining an integral part of the 40k verse. Tell me your thoughts in the comments. So next we return to the Necrons. On paper, just like the Tyranids, one of the most formidable factions, possessing technology that surpasses nearly every other race by an almost inconceivable margin. They're the apex of technological supremacy. Oh, and also they have, you know, the Catan, just the shards of gods on their side. The problem with the Necron is, how do you make them work without just hitting the auto-resolve button for all battles? Well, largely due to what has happened already, which is that most Necron are supposedly still awakening and that they're not paying full attention yet. The problem is, what happens when they do? Because similarly to the Tyranid, you can only get away with describing them sitting on their hands for so long. Eventually they're going to have to get in the mix. But unlike the Tyranids, the Necrons are in many ways much worse, because where the Tyranid threat is out of sight and has a little room for manoeuvre, the Necrons are very much observed. They're straight up overpowered to the extreme. Their technology includes devices such as the Celestial Orrery. What does this do? Oh, nothing much, it just allows them to erase stars from existence at a touch of a button, and phase-based weaponry which ignores conventional defences. Their base level weapons just tear apart a target's atomic bonds. It strips the bodies of humans and all biological forms apart, atom by atom, molecule by molecule. So, you know, a little more advanced than the projectile weapons that the Imperium favours. But despite this overwhelming state of technology, the Necron tend to be written in ways which prevent them from using any of their true power. Now, whilst that may be for obvious reasons, it creates an inherent contradiction in their lore, where they're portrayed as being this unstoppable force, but also paradoxically one which inexplicably fails to be unstoppable and dominating. Now, far be it from me to just lay the blame at any specific door, it's always been a frustration for me, and something I've mentioned before, that the Necron as they were in 3rd edition had to change, because they fitted very well narratively into the galaxy of M41. Originally, the Necrons were depicted as this ancient force trying to outlast entropy, but had been slowly awakening from millennia of slumber. And as such, their numbers were very minimal. They were basically just a side issue, albeit a powerful one. But some people didn't like the fact that they were very anonymous and they were just kind of like living metal zombies, effectively. So we fast forward to the 5th edition, and Games Workshop has decided to expand their lore and significantly increase their power level. Now you have the Silent King, their long absent ruler, returning to unify them, and unlike the Imperium, which is constantly struggling with its own decay, the Necrons have thousands if not millions of tomb worlds, each with the potential to devastate entire sectors. Now admittedly, many of these are in a terrible state, some are unawakened, others even destroyed. But nonetheless, by any logical assessment, even with their available power now, they should be well on their way to conquering the galaxy, in despite the fact that their dynasties may not all get along. Because unlike other factions, they don't require supplies, logistics, reinforcement in a conventional sense. The Tyranids are limited by their biological needs. Chaos thrive on humanity's heart of darkness and psychic instability. The Necrons don't have all these kind of constraints. They don't experience fatigue or disorganization in the same way that biological beings do. They can travel across interstellar distances. They can manipulate time. They can unleash apocalyptic firepower at will. The sheer scale of their technological superiority means that realistically, no other faction should be able to present any real challenge to them. Now, with all of that in mind, what do you think the Necrons are doing now? Something about pylons, and the Pariah Nexus? In terms of actual military power, they tend to be represented as this competing force with others rather than just a singular dominant power, which they should logically be. It all comes back to what I said in the beginning, the lore is kept anchored to the tabletop. Because for everything to make reasonable sense, Games Workshop has to keep the setting in this perpetual state of conflict. Sometimes they're going to appear unstoppable, obliterating worlds. Elsewhere, they just inexplicably lose to Space Marines that theoretically should have no chance against their technology. It's these kind of inconsistencies which damage how they're perceived as a faction. Because if you just even forget about their indomitable power, the Necron's intelligence and strategic experience alone should vastly outmatch basically all other factions, maybe perhaps apart from the Eldar. The Silent King has eons of experience. The Necron Overlords are highly intelligent when they're not arguing inside their own heads, and shouldn't be making any kind of miscalculations of their human counterparts, again, with the caveat unless their brain is falling out of their head. So what did I think about in terms of the Necrons justifying this lack of galactic dominance, whilst also not immediately destroying every other faction with ease as we increase their relative power? Internal strife. Internal struggles continue within the Necron dynasties. While the return of the Silent King provides a unifying leader, he's not completely unified. Not all Necrons follow him. There remain divisions between and within Necron dynasties, such as isolationist factions who refuse to join his cause, dynasties with conflicting objectives, or just overlords seeking their own dominance, all of which are going to be natural barriers to their expansion. So you might say, well, Lutin, hang on a minute, I thought you said this was a problem for Games Workshop to fix that they can't solve. Yeah, that's right, because despite all of these things being described, we don't see any of that. You don't hear about any of that sort of stuff. It's all just kind of vaguely there. It's the kind of thing which we know is supposed to be happening, but it's completely not visible, and so you don't feel it. That's the point. Then we have psychic vulnerabilities. As already noted, Necrons are anathema to the warp. One balancing factor could be their inability to properly counter large-scale psychic phenomena. The rise of the Great Rift and the increasing power of Chaos could present them with unique challenges, which then hinder their expansion, not to mention the Tyranids. If the Elder are able to perform some sort of resurgence also, this could help to minimise the impact of the Necron. But the Rift and the Eldar remain this curious question, because there is evidence that at one time the Eldar and Necron worked together toward the common threat of the warp. And I sometimes wonder whether, in this situation now with the Cicatrix Maledictum, that the Eldar and Necron are still not going to potentially work together to solve that problem. Then, entropy. So, while the Necrons possess time-manipulating technology, this doesn't necessarily mean that they're masters of time. Because despite assertions to the contrary, the effects of entropy have been keenly felt by the Necron. They had at one point considered just biding their time while all other races went extinct, considering themselves exempt from the degrading effects of time. But although their existing forces are insanely powerful and more than capable of causing extreme damage to entire sectors of the galaxy, maybe this is a misunderstood perception. Because many of the worlds that were thought to hold vast numbers of Necron and be awakening are only able to, perhaps, field a smaller number of those contained within. Despite all efforts, they cannot be revived. And thus, it would take the Necron a very long time to truly achieve the scale of power that would then allow them unrestricted conquest. Now, perhaps the most powerful but rarely spoken about balance would be the Necrons having this sense of some of their most powerful weapons and tools having significant consequence. It has been alluded to that they have some sense that using their most powerful technology would in fact not be good for themselves, like the mentioned Celestial Orrery, for example. Yes, they can blot out suns from existence, but there's an underlying sense rarely mentioned that suggests the Necrons have this inherent understanding of the galaxy due to how far advanced in technology they are, and their understanding extends beyond the dimensions we see and can measure. So while it seems all-powerful to be able to just extinguish a star, something prevents them from doing so, and I think that is an intriguing angle that should be played up considerably more, that although they have this power, they understand there are limitations that are attached to that. So in terms of the Necron, yes, as things stand, their technology and military capabilities are so advanced that they very likely should have already conquered the galaxy. But this inherent need to maintain balance and conflict within the setting forces them into relying upon internal divisions, consistent confirmation of lost or weakened tomb worlds, and even possibly establishing adjusted limitations to their technology to then make them work in the setting. Basically, the Necrons are one of the most challenging problems. They must remain a terrifying dominant force, yet also their existence cannot make them an automatic win condition. Trying to somehow make that work is not an easy tightrope to walk. Now, this is one I have spoken about previously in a sideways manner. Go and see my Dawn Should Stay Dead video for that. The resurrection of Rabute Gilliman marked a significant departure from the established tone of 40k to that point. In isolation, it was all well and good, but with the return of the Lion now as well, it has become clear that the potential floodgates have been opened for speculation regarding the resurrection of other Primarchs, which has only intensified, because of course, everybody wants their Primarch back. Now if the trend continues, we could soon see the revival of other legendary figures such as Leman Russ, Vulcan, who knows, maybe even Jakarti Khan. Now, beyond the obvious business benefits of reviving immensely popular characters and bringing them out in miniature form, hence the intermittent timing of their return, as I outlined in my Dawn video, once you start resurrecting or returning lost figures, it really diminishes the stakes and uniqueness of each resurrection or just return. Beyond that, it also undermines the gravity attached to lore developments, because at that point, it's essentially become a serial TV series. You know that certain main characters are not dying, because they're just an integral part of the show. So despite the return of Gilliman being an era-defining, groundbreaking event in 40k lore, upending this sense of the Imperium being a crumbling bureaucratic nightmare just held together by outdated institutions and religious zeal, his return threw up this sudden sense and possibility, a hope of rational fairness, competence, and most importantly, just the exploration of new possibilities in the setting. But it also set this precedent, which immediately raised questions. If one Primarch can return, why not others? Now with the Lion as well, it's increasingly difficult to justify why certain Primarchs would remain absent when others return. Gilliman's return was so momentous, precisely because it was unexpected and unprecedented. Now if Dawn, Russ, Vulcan, the Khan, and I'm not even joking, Sanguinius were to return, it would become a routine occurrence rather than a shocking event. It would just erode entirely this sense of profound drama and loss, which is a defining characteristic of Warhammer 40,000's storytelling. But effectively now, the box is open, the genie's out of the bottle, and the endless Primarch speculation and demands continue. It is something I strongly want to note my objection to, because I think in the long term, it will be nothing but detrimental to the setting. And people are going to say, oh, Lutin, well, you like the Ultramarines, that's why you're happy with everything as it is. No. Maintaining a balance between narrative, impact, and consistency is very critical. My thoughts about how this could be handled going forward, though. Well, for one, a hard limit. Now, it's a little out there, but we're dealing with some really headache-inducing issues here. So currently, Gilliman, when he went to visit the Emperor, we don't know what was said there. We do know that Gilliman came out kind of white as a sheet and very unhappy about it. We also do not know some details surrounding the aftermath of the heresy. So I think one possible solution to kind of mitigate and stem this tide of Primarch return is to create a scenario whereby we discover that the Emperor had only intended for a select few Primarchs to return. Perhaps Gilliman, besides having his mortal wounding and Lionel Johnson, had been intended for that purpose. And while others were either too far gone or deliberately assigned to other roles, the Khan, for example, was said to just be lost in the webway. Given Eldrad Ulthuan's close involvement with Gilliman now, there's the potential for them to either reveal how he could return, or perhaps even the fate of some other Primarchs, or maybe he can reveal some fate which befell the Khan and that he won't be returning. And I think there's obviously many ways in which you could deliver the news that certain characters may not return, or maybe they return for like a last ditch do or die moment, they arrive and die in the process of saving some critical battle or figure. The second aspect to this is irreversible fate. Now, some Primarchs have met their definitive ends that should remain untouched. Sanguinius's death at the hands of Horus, one of the most iconic moments in Warhammer history, bringing him back would not only feel contrived, but lessen the impact of his sacrifice. It would be insane. That must not happen. Similarly, as I've noted, if Dawn is dead, keeping him that way preserves the weight of his story as well. Both those Primarchs should, in my opinion, remain deceased, for in doing so they contribute more to the setting than they would do in return. Were Dawn to return, in my opinion, it would basically amount to nothing more than fan service, and it would cheapen and diminish the weight of 40k lore across the entire setting. And lastly, narrowing the focus. it's very clear that one thing everybody's waiting for is the Lion meeting with Gilliman. I think if this were to happen sooner than later, that would help to focus in on a sense of the now, instead of relying on resurrecting more Primarchs who then just do nothing in the continuing narrative. From this meeting between the two Primarchs, it would then give the opportunity to explore deeper political, ideological struggles within the Imperium. Because the return of just two Primarchs is already creating tension, Gilliman's pragmatic rationalism contrasting sharply with the Lion's unbreakable ego and confidence. And that's not an insult toward him either, he just had a tendency to see himself as being infallible, and we know how that tends to go. So while the return of Gilliman and the Lion reinvigorated 40k to a degree, it also creates an ongoing dilemma. How many Primarchs should return? If too many are resurrected, then the setting risks losing any sense of permanence. There needs to be some sort of reasonable offset to the current out-of-control feeling that all of them are just going to return. I think that confirming certain Primarchs being beyond reach, beyond return, would be a good start. You're drawing a line in the sand and saying, look, some of these guys are not coming back. By doing so, they can ensure that the return of any other Primarch therefore would then remain a momentous, impactful event rather than a routine expectation, which is unfortunately starting to become the tone I have felt from the 40k community, this expectation that the return of all Primarchs is inevitable, and I truly hope that is not the case. Now, of course, 40k built upon this foundation of eternal conflict, and there is nothing more genre-defining within that than the Imperium and Chaos remaining locked in an unending struggle. In many respects, this conflict serves as the central pillar of the setting, but it also creates a fundamental unsolvable problem. The conflict between the Imperium and Chaos is an unwinnable stalemate, because no side can ever truly triumph without destroying the premise of the setting. And while that paradox exists to ensure the 40k galaxy remains viable in terms of ongoing storytelling, gameplay, it also traps the narrative in a dead end. Now, when I did my Chaos Could Rule the Galaxy video, I had to do some serious, broad rationalization to make that work. Because, in truth, defeating the Imperium or Chaos would remove one of the core forces which drive the narrative. Conversely, Chaos can't overwhelm the Imperium because that would mean the fall of humanity, the effective end of the primary faction. So in a more literal sense as we understand it, the warp and the nightmares within are this twisted mirror of reality. The two are inextricably linked. And so the idea of destroying one or the other, it could just be fundamentally impossible. And what that means is there can never be really a victory or anything approaching it, which leads us into the final topic. But the Cicatrix Maledictum, also known as the Great Rift, initially seemed like a game-changing event. The Warp Rift split through the galaxy, dramatically increasing Chaos incursions and leading to major upheavals within the Imperium, and while there has been narrative around that, we still haven't really got to grips with what is occurring within Imperium Nihilus. And I say that because, in practice, this whole thing functioned as little more than a new way to just perpetuate the same conflict, albeit in a slightly altered form. The Imperium remains embattled, Chaos remains an ever-present threat, there's no resolution ever in sight, and rather than meaningfully shifting the balance, these changes just reinforce this internal stalemate. The only progress made has been in the battle for the Nachmund Gauntlet. And while Chaos appears to be winning, it seems unlikely that they're just going to reach Terra and bring down the Imperium. And I guess I'll note that this problem extends also beyond the Imperium and Chaos. Other factions like the Eldari, the Orcs, the Tau, are largely just relegated to side conflicts which rarely impact the overarching war. And the setting as a whole is designed, like we say, to maintain that equilibrium. Yes, on the one hand, that is understandable. On the other, it makes it difficult to introduce any meaningful consequence or sense of momentum. And that is, of course, the unsolvable problem for 40k, perpetual conflict. And the reason I'm talking about all of this today is because I think that will be an issue going forward as it expands and tries to move into a wider audience, because people are going to want to see actual progression of a story. every major law shakeup inherently, as it stands, becomes temporary. Any major advances made by the Imperium are just undone later by different Chaos incursions. Chaos victories never really push beyond a certain threshold. And it's that artificial balance which limits the scope of storytelling by preventing the universe from ever evolving in any meaningful way. The reason they could go all in and push so hard with the Heresy story is because it had already happened. It didn't really matter how aggressive and brutal that ending was, because it was 10,000 years ago from the contemporary period. And then we come back to Gilliman again. His return was this major development. It promised change for the Imperium, his leadership, his reform, his attempt to rebuild humanity's crumbling empire. It initially suggested a huge shift. Was the Imperium about to return to what had been intended during the Crusade? Would the shackles be taken off and forward progress, enlightened rule, finally come? Well, no. Despite those developments, the fundamental structure of the Imperium just stayed the same. The ecclesiarchy and the bureaucracy couldn't change, the Imperium is still beset on all sides, the war against Chaos rages on. Gilliman's return didn't really mark the beginning of a new era, it was just an event with the same ongoing cycles of conflict. And this stagnation is what 40k suffered from previously, so it's mad in a way. It introduced this whole new big event of things, and then it kind of just went back to how things were before. Which in some respects I find very funny, because when looking at Chaos itself and the great game, that is an exact mirror, effectively. It's this struggle between different entities that are all battling to try and make progress forward and one-up one another, but as much as they try, they never can, because everything has to balance in the end. The Chaos Gods and their followers have waged war against the Imperium for 10,000 years, but somehow, despite countless invasions and cataclysmic events, they've never managed to achieve a huge breakthrough. Abaddon the Despoiler's Black Crusades are just a prime example. Each brings massive devastation, but somehow they fall short of a decisive victory. Or they sort of do, but then they just run away. It creates this paradox where Chaos is portrayed as an unstoppable force, but is also perpetually prevented from achieving an ultimate goal. So how would I look to break this cycle, but also not undermine the setting's fundamental themes? Well, I think quite obviously you can't have either side just be destroyed or even heavily curtailed. But Games Workshop could introduce new stakes which move beyond the default Imperium versus Chaos dichotomy. Again, narrowing focus, as I said earlier. One of the most compelling aspects with 40k is the internal strife in the Imperium. It's often talked about in this very broad sense though. And as I spoke recently about the apostasy, my continuing enjoyment always of the Crime 40k series, which focuses more on human elements in the Imperium, a massive amount of people that I speak to were fascinated by Gilliman's attempts at reform. People really loved those sections of the Dark Imperium series, where it looks at Gilliman trying to reform and work within the Imperium. Basically, they like the civilian bureaucratic aspects because it's interesting and it gives you world building. And it also sees Gilliman having to struggle with sparked tensions in the Ecclesiarchy, the Inquisition, and other groups. So I think refocusing from the endless Chaos grind to an internal war, perhaps even a cold war, between Gilliman's loyalists and more reactionary forces within the Imperium could introduce broader stakes which evolve the setting without requiring Chaos to just win or lose. But there could be traitors and heretics in the midst there that are all sort of working for power struggles. Then also make the Necrons or Tyranids a true endgame threat. Chaos has always been this primary threat, but as we noted, the Necrons and Tyranids are significant galactic threats, but they have remained largely still secondary antagonists compared to Chaos. Maybe it's time we switch that around. The Great Rift since it arrived has been pretty vague. There's this sense that the Necron are attempting to also set a course that will look to closing it. Maybe there will be some evolving story with the Emperor and human psychers emerging en masse before that time. I could imagine a situation where we see Chaos once again being relegated to the Eye of Terror. The Rift is largely, but maybe not fully, closed. In the aftermath of that, the Tyranids could launch a massive new tendril into the Imperial domain, requiring a huge refocusing of resources. Maybe this would be a campaign that sees the Tyranid have some genetic trouble or viral solution introduced, maybe from Kor. Then the Necrons, in the aftermath of closing the Rift, are refocusing their attention. They become this ultimate new threat. And we see the expansion of dynasties all across the galaxy. The Imperium has to respond and adjust its immediate priorities. Now with chaos you can go in a lot of different directions, but I just wanted to throw in something there that I've thought about. It's less dramatic, but it's often been hinted at in the past with descriptions of chaos worlds or planets within the boundaries of the warp. Chaos is always portrayed as this very destructive force generally, and it's always of course traitor marines attached with some oddities. But its influence extends beyond battlefield conflict. In fact, one of my favourite characters was in Gate of Bones. There is a human cultist who is basically taken under the wing of a Wordbearer space marine, and her development is really interesting because you start to see how a human can fall into chaos and become steadily more powerful. It's terrifying for her in the beginning, but by the end you start to see she's really developing this strength as a character, and that goes on into other stories later. So I think if they decided to push a greater emphasis on chaos, corruption, internal subversion, ideological struggles within Chaos Worlds and the Imperium, it's this human element that could add new layers to the war. What if chaos began winning, not through military victories, but through slow, insidious corruption of key Imperial institutions, worlds falling without the need for the same tedious, crushing military campaigns? I think it would be genuinely very interesting, but of course, maybe that's just me. While undoubtedly the stalemate between the Imperium and Chaos is foundational to 40k, it also leads to this narrative stagnation, where neither side can really progress. The stakes need to be felt more keenly, and that means elevating it above other existential threats like the Necron or the Tyranids, or sidelining it so that real permanent consequences can be felt from other major events. But I'd also go so far as to say that maybe the only way for a real sense of the Imperium versus Chaos comes back to what I was talking about earlier, sacrifice and loss being fundamental to 40k storytelling. Maybe we need a devastating loss to instill the sense of real, permanent consequence and the stakes of play. Now, could it be a returned Primarch? It could, but maybe not. There are many other Imperial figures, Astartes or otherwise, who could also take the fall. But perhaps that is one of the ways in which they can start to rebalance things. Characters have to be lost to make it feel real. So now, of course, we come to the unavoidable ultimate final problem. And please do not put me to the fires for this, but let's be real, the Emperor is a very bizarre figure. And for me, remains a huge, huge problem in 40k. Because I never stop seeing the questions of, wait, he did what? And why? Wait a minute, if he was all-knowing, why didn't he do XYZ? And on and on and on. It's eye-bleedingly frustrating. The Emperor is often depicted as having unparalleled foresight, able to manipulate events on a galactic scale. He orchestrated the Great Crusade. He engineered the Primarchs along with help, and sought to elevate humanity beyond reliance on religion and superstition. However, his actions frequently contradict the notion that he was this all-knowing strategist in neck-breakingly jarring fashion, and it leaves people like me wrapping my brain in rationalization knots just to explain the basic beats of his story. Now, obviously, I have covered some of this stuff in my ongoing Emperor of Man series, but the basic elements are 1. Wrong from the start. The Emperor knew of the dangers of chaos, but he made these inexplicable decisions which led to the heresy. He understood the ruinous powers, but he didn't prepare his Primarchs against their influence in really any way. Now connected to that, if the Primarchs were so vital to his plans, how is it possible that Erda could scatter them all over the galaxy? And then the final nail in the coffin for me, we have the infamous moment where Malkador is telling and suggesting that it was all intentional, that he knew the Primarchs were going to fall, that he knew the heresy would happen, it was all part of their plan. Now a lot of people say, no, Malkador was just saying a load of nonsense there. I'm sorry, I believe him. Second, the unstable Primarchs. Many of them exhibited really severe personality flaws which contributed to the heresy and the downfall of humanity at that time. Angron with his rage, Kurz's paranoia, Lorgar's fanaticism. These are not minor things, and yes, they were considerably exacerbated by the planets they ended up being scattered to. Many of the Primarchs ended up on these planets which suspiciously just happened to perfectly align with bringing out of them the very worst aspects of their character. And these were not small things, they were really fatal weaknesses. So if the Emperor was such a brilliant geneticist and strategist, why did he not account or assist those geneticists who were working for him to fix these flaws or create fail-safes to prevent their corruption? Yes, he was always pressured and under time, but this seems like really important stuff to get correct. And then lastly, of course, the big one, withdrawing from the heresy. In the later stages of the Crusade, the Emperor chose to retreat to his project, the Webway experiment beneath Terra, thus leaving the Imperium in the hands of Horus and the Primarchs. And that decision directly allowed the War Master to spread his traitorous corruption unchecked. If the Emperor had remained engaged with his sons in the Imperium, it's possible he would have prevented or lessened the impact there. But again, maybe that's the point, and it really contributes to this sense that the Emperor knew exactly what was going to happen and just let it occur. Now, these are not even all of the issues, it's just a couple of the big ones that I see people always talk about. There are so many more. But these contradictions make it very difficult to understand the Emperor's true intentions in any kind of reasonable way. Was he really this omniscient, immortal mastermind whose plan simply failed in execution, which kind of doesn't even make sense when you say it out loud? Or was he a flawed leader who overestimated his own abilities and failed to anticipate the consequences of his actions, which seems a lot more plausible? But it's not just the events either, it's the Emperor's characterization. He fluctuates between two extremes, this infallible godlike being who is very vague and mysterious, but you get this sense that he knows exactly what he's doing at every step of the way, or a very deeply flawed, just strangely powerful human. Of course, maybe he was both, but if he truly foresaw everything, then his mistakes, such as underestimating Horus, failing to protect his Primarchs, ignoring Chaos, do not really make any sense. And this is why I've often suggested that it's just not believable that these were things he didn't expect to happen, because I think even somebody who wasn't psychic could see all of that coming, and therefore it must be intentional. Conversely, if he was this highly intelligent, powerful psychic, but ultimately just a man, as he always claimed, then these moments of near omniscience, such as predicting the fall of humanity, having the vision in designing the Primarch project, also seem jarringly out of place. And then all of that is just compounded further by the vagueness, the reluctance to define the Emperor's nature. Because without any clarity, the Emperor just remains this paradox, both the greatest genius in the galaxy, the most powerful psyker, the architect also of its most catastrophic failures. Which I know is the whole point. But I also feel this is one of the most annoying problems in 40k, because it's too vague, I think there could and there should be at least a few more leaning winks and nods, because I really do feel at this point in time, it's warranted. So, solutions, if you want to call it that. The Emperor wasn't omniscient. At one point, the Emperor notes that he cannot see what is coming next. And I think rather than presenting him as this all-knowing being, it needs to somehow be established that the Emperor was, yes, immensely powerful as a psyker, a farseer, but was still bound by the limitations of a mortal mind. He foresaw many possible futures, but he couldn't control every detail. I think that is actually pretty clear. Some of his mistakes, though, were genuine miscalculations rather than part of a grand design, and that is heavily implied. But I think a little more concrete detail would really help to solidify that, and in doing so would immediately allow many other oddities to fall into place and be largely resolved. Contingency plans. Another way to explain the apparent failures in his strategy is that he had multiple contingency plans, which is again hinted at. Perhaps lost records or secret writings could uncover his true intention and show that he was prepared for setbacks but couldn't prevent them all. We could well imagine Sororitas or Inquisitors diving deep into a lost world to then find relics from the age prior to the heresy. And again, it's possible that we're going to get some resolution about this kind of stuff when we get that new material from the Beckwin Eisenhorn series. And then the Primarchs themselves. The Primarchs, to me, have never been adequately explained, in the sense of they themselves having some kind of genetic failure in design. That to me seems a really weak explanation. With the return of the Lion and Gilliman, I think it would be really interesting to have those two sit down and have some kind of discussion where they decide to evaluate all that has happened so far. The end of the heresy, the scouring, everything which has taken place so far. I would love to see a combination of Gilliman's logic and the Lion's self-assured nature to go through and do this kind of forensic investigation, get a better understanding of their place and the state of things to come. Perhaps this would tie in with Gilliman having visited the Emperor. Maybe they begin to accept that they were not really his sons, but tools. Perhaps Gilliman brutally forces this concept upon the Lion in a dramatic, emotional scene, telling him, "Don't you realise what we really were?" and so on and so on. It's the idea that their extreme personalities were very, very deliberate. The Emperor cared little or nothing for how damaged he made them. He needed them to fulfil a specific role. That's kind of where I'm thinking. The Emperor may have believed, therefore, that he could then control them better, but misjudged that massively, and that led to their corruption. And then lastly, the biggest one, the Emperor's arrogance. The Emperor's greatest failing could be him overestimating himself. And that's suggested from the perpetuals throughout the heresy. Other perpetuals strongly disapprove of the Emperor and often will throw blunt disdain toward what he is doing. And they're the only ones who are really willing to do that because they see him almost like at an equal level, whereas all humans see him like in a godlike state even before that was a thing. So very often perpetuals appear disgusted, offended by his belief that he alone could guide humanity without relying upon others. And as I've said, this is another aspect implied throughout, if not outright stated by perpetuals. But it would really explain his irrational decisions, his refusal to share knowledge, his dismissal of chaos, his insistence on secrecy. All of that could stem from hubris rather than omniscience. And again, how can you really acknowledge, how can you really make this a thing? There are many novellas which accompany the Heresy series, the Siege of Terror series, and I could really see the potential for something like that down the line, where we get a flashback, we get some kind of vision back, where it really further emphasises that. Now, I fully accept, of course, that the inconsistencies in the Emperor are by design. Of course, I understand that the entire narrative of 40k itself thrives on these vague mysteries, the contradictions. It all gives it depth and thematic richness, not to mention the endless speculation. I totally understand all that. But it does come at a cost, because it creates narrative issues that are very difficult to resolve. And for the longest time, I was happy and content to just accept that as it was. But the longer the lack of clarity drags on and on, the more difficult I feel it will be in the future to build this well-defined narrative. Because one way or the other, now the timeline is moving forward, it will eventually need to address these lore inconsistencies to maintain a true sense of immersion and cohesion in the narrative. And I really understand that some may argue that these contradictions add to the nature, the mythos of the Emperor, and that clarifying any of his intentions and limitations would in fact not strengthen the narrative, that by establishing he was visionary but not infallible, that some of his decisions were just genuine mistakes rather than calculated gambits, it all is just going to reduce the Emperor from a figure of legend to just some powerful psyker. There would be a price to pay, certainly, but I think it would come at the benefit of allowing the Emperor and his character to be more internally consistent. But I think with where the stories are beginning to go now, with the potential for the Emperor to resurrect, be a god, or who knows what is going to happen, there does need to be some more clear definition about just what he was. It'll never happen, of course, but it's still very enjoyable to think about and discuss. I greatly thank all of you for checking out the video today. As always, if you enjoyed, do please drop a like. Tell me your thoughts, your comments down below about some of the issues in the lore that you see. And as always, I will see you in the next one.